I remember when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 35 years old, 39 years old. And I'll do the math for you, 1981. I'm 68 now. But when I came here, I was 39 years old, and everybody in the room looked like I do now. Didn't have much hair. Most of it was gray. And, I just said, I don't know. Anyway, let me start from the beginning. I have a sister, and she doesn't drink, and sometimes I wish she would. my dad is dead now, but my mom is still alive. She just celebrated her 92nd birthday. She still knows how to. Man, she can still push my buttons, you know. She installed them. She knows right where they are. She knows just how to do it. Anyway, so it was just me and my sister and my dad, and I remember very early age. And I only remember this because there was a big argument about it. We lived with my grandparents when I was a little boy. And I'm going back to when I was about 3 or 4 years old that this happened. And on a Saturday morning, my grandfather didn't have to go to work. And my mom would be busy taking care of my little sister. She's a year younger than I am. And so I would get dressed and go downstairs with Grandpa and have breakfast with him, you know. And he had eggs with beans, and he had mustard on his beans. So I had eggs and beans, and I had mustard on my beans. And after he finished his breakfast, he'd go and he'd get the bottle out of the closet, and he'd pour himself a shot. And he'd toss that down, and then he'd get a teaspoon, and he'd pour a little in the teaspoon, and he'd say, come on, Ronnie, get your cough syrup. And so one Saturday morning, my mom caught him doing that. And, man, she raised hell. I remember it was all kind of hollering. I was afraid. I was a little guy, and I remember being scared. But my grandpa, he used to take me to the bar on Saturday morning, and he'd play his numbers, and he'd pick up the Saturday morning paper, and I would go, he would sit me on the bar, and the guys would buy me Cokes, and I would get chips and popcorn, and I just loved the attention. So when I grew up, as a teenager, I couldn't wait to drink, and I just couldn't wait to be able to go to a bar. I just loved to go to a bar. I wanted to go to a bar. I wanted to hang out. I wanted to be one of the guys, you know. I just really wanted to be one of the guys. I started my first experience drinking. I was 16 years old. I drank some beer, and nothing spectacular happened. I didn't even get sick. But by the time I was 18, I had an ID that said I was 21. And I was drinking every day. I was in a barroom every day that I could be. And from the age of 18 to 22, I didn't have too much trouble. I had a couple of problems, I guess. I didn't like to go to work on Monday mornings because my hangovers were, oh, God, I used to get such terrible hangovers. I'd always have the dry heaves, and my head never bothered me. It was my stomach, you know. I had butterflies. It was like my insides wanted to jump out. I don't know if anybody can identify with that, but anyway, I used to get awfully sick, and so I didn't want to go to work on a Monday morning. And I only had one automobile accident. I remember my mom and my sister were going on a skiing trip. I was in a bar, and she called me up, and she said, hey, we're going to need a ride to to catch the bus. She's calling me at about 11 o'clock at night, and I said, oh, okay. She said, you want to come down and give us a ride? And I said, sure. So I left the bar expecting to go home, and they'd be ready, and I'm going to take them, drop them off at the bus station, and I'm going to go back to the bar. Well, they're not ready. And that's what was my mother's M.O. anyway. She was never ready. But I'm sitting there, and I'm watching the clock. You know, I'm going to miss last call here. You know, come on, guys, let's go. And forget about it. Now, last call is come and gone, and I'm still waiting for them. And they finally get ready, and I'm mad. Man, I'm ripping. So I get in the car, and I start driving like a maniac down the street. And, you know, it's in the wintertime. And up in Massachusetts, when they plow the roads, they have these trucks go around with sand, and they sprinkle sand on the ice. Well, there's some sand on the road, and some guy walked out in front of me while I was driving kind of fast down the street. And I slammed on the brakes, and the car slid. and I smashed into his car. He had his car parked on the left-hand side of the street, and I hit it with the right front fender of my car. And my mother and sister didn't say anything. They got their bags and got out of the car, and they got a taxi, and they went on skiing. And I'm screaming in the middle of the street. You know, I'm so mad because I couldn't make last call. I smashed my car. And also, that was my first automobile accident. Not long after that accident, I was 21 years old. I was in a barroom, and I got involved in a barroom fight. And this guy took me out beautiful. Boy, I'll tell you. You know, I'm making it for the door, the side entrance, and somebody put their hand on my shoulder, and I turned around to see who it was, and something shiny was coming. I tried to put my hands up, but it was too late. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in a hospital, and this doctor was stitching my eyes. And I guess this guy did a tap dance on my face after he took me out. I had 15 stitches over my eyes, and I spent 9 days in the hospital with a head concussion. And I said, man, you know, that should have been a big signpost right there to stay out of barrooms. But all that did was, for me, was I wasn't going to let that happen again. I started learning how to take care of myself and watch my back, and I did. And I didn't get hurt like that again in a barroom. I had a lot of other fights, and I didn't win most of them, but I didn't get hurt like that anyway. I was able to take care of myself most of the time. I got drafted when I was 22 years old. I went into the United States Army. Went through basic training with very little trouble. Went into advanced training down at Fort Bliss, Texas, which is in El Paso. And, geez, I loved it there. It was, you could walk from downtown El Paso over into Juarez, Mexico in about 10 minutes. And Juarez was a wide open town. I was 22 years old. And I was, you know, drinking real good into drinking in them days. And it was party time, man. I mean, it was everything that was there, 24/7. And I didn't miss any duty, and I didn't really get in any trouble. I got arrested once for being drunk in public. That's the first time I ever got arrested. And all I did was fall asleep on a park bench waiting for the bus. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, the El Paso police came along with their billy club, you know, tapping me on the bottom of my feet and got me up and took me to the... You know, because I was military, they wouldn't take me to the police station and just let me go in the morning. They had to take me down to the Border Patrol, and they had to call Fort Bliss, and Fort Bliss had to get a hold of the company that I was in, and they had to send a guy down there to get from the duty officer, had to get me. It was a big thing. They made a big thing out of nothing. All I did was fall asleep on a bus stop bench. But I got arrested, the military didn't like that too much, and I got an Article 15 on that. For those of you know what that is, you know, a conduct unbecoming of a soldier or something like that. Anyways, I got a fine, and I had to spend X amount of days extra duty, and I was restricted for a couple of weeks or something. And I was being shipped to Germany, and I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay there because of Juarez, and I was partying, having a good time, and I went to Germany, and I got to Germany, and I was in Frankfurt, and they let us, I had to catch a troop train the next day to my unit, and they let us go to the EM Club, and they sold us German beer, and they had this stuff called Beck's beer, and it was 12 ounces, it was 15 cents a bottle. And I'm sitting at the bar, and I'm talking to a couple of guys, and we're having a few beers, and we're having a good time. For a buck and a half, I had 10 of them. You know, and I said, well, I got to get up in the morning. I got to catch the troop train to Bremerhaven, so I got to go. And my legs wouldn't work. I was talking like I'm talking right now, but I just couldn't get off of that damn. You know, so they had to help me back to my bunk anyway. I thought, man, that's a pretty good beer. I like that stuff. And so I thought, well, maybe Germany won't be so bad after all. And when I got to my unit, it was 35 of us, 32 enlisted men and three officers. And we, what we did was we were teaching the Germans how to maintain and mate nuclear warheads to Nike Hercules missiles and how to fire them. And we did a lot of guard duty, and because we did that, we had a lot of time off. And down, the Americans had, we were on a German compound. It was a German Air Force, post, I guess you'd say. And the Americans had their own building. And in the cellar of the American building, the guys had built a nice bar, and they had a one-armed bandit, and they had TV, and they had, I never knew that Tonto could speak German until I saw him riding up to the Lone Ranger going, V. Gates. It was weird. American Indians, I speak in German. It was something else. And we watched German TV. And but that was it. That's all they did. You know, when they're off duty, they wrote letters home. They hung around down in that cellar in the bar there drinking, and they didn't go nowhere. And I wanted to go find out where the girls were, where was the dances, where was the parties going on, you know, what was going on. So I met this German sergeant there in that compound who spoke English with a British accent, and he taught me enough German to get me in trouble. And so I started going downtown, and I had a good time. Man, I found out where the dances were on Friday and Saturday nights, and I found out where to go downtown to drink, to have a nice drink, and I started to learn a few more words in German, and I could go downtown with a quarter in my pocket and come back to the post drunk and have a buck. You know, I mean, I really got along great with those people. They love me. See, they don't like to be laughed at, but they don't mind laughing at you. And I didn't care if they were laughing at me, if they were buying. It was all right with me. And so I was having a good time. And in the summertime, they have these little festivals, you know, and every little town has its little festival. And something like Tampa has the Pirate Days and stuff like the Gasparilla, right? So they have their little shindigs and festivals. And I met this girl at one of these things, and she wanted me to go home with her. She wanted to introduce me to her folks, and I thought, yeah, okay. So she... her and I went. We went to her house, and her mother had a little variety store. They had a little variety store, and she brought me in the store and introduced me to her mom. And then she brought me into this other little room that was like part of the variety store, and it was a bar, and that's where her father was. And I thought, you own this? Yeah, this is ours. I said, all right. And she's got a bar, and she's not a bad-looking girl. I said, this is great. I'm not going to let her slide, man. You know, and so I didn't. I married her. I married her, and I brought her back to the States in 1966. And I had to go. I was going to aircraft maintenance school in Newport News, Virginia. And I really wanted to pass that school, and I wanted to do well in it. And so I kind of toned my drinking down a little bit. And of course, at that time, I was only a Spec 4. And I wasn't making a whole lot of money, and I couldn't afford to drink a whole lot. So I did pretty well in school, and I got shipped to Montgomery, Alabama, to Maxwell Air Force Base, which is great duty Army personnel on an Air Force base. And we had about five Army aircraft there, four or five. And my job there was to be a crew chief and work on aircraft that needed the fixing. And that's mostly all we did. I lived off post in a mobile home, and I started to get hanging around with them guys at that unit after work. They'd bring out the beers, you know, they had a refrigerator and a thing, and they'd all have a few beers, and then they'd go home. Well, I couldn't do that. I couldn't go home. Once I had a few beers, I had to go to the bar afterwards, and so I was drinking pretty heavy, and my wife wasn't too happy about that. Anyways, I came down on orders to go to Vietnam in December of 67, and I left. I was able to stay home until the day after Christmas, which was my birthday, and I was born the 26th of December. And anyways, the day after Christmas, I left home and I flew out to the West Coast and I reported to Oakland Army Base, not before I stopped in San Francisco and put my foot on the brass rail out there at the Fisherman's Pier and, you know, drank beer and got to the strip where they had all the go-go. Back in the 60s, they had go-go. They had little balconies hanging off the walls with girls dancing in them. Yeah, anyways. I had to see that, you know. And so I got drunk in San Francisco that night. The next day I reported in the Oakland Army Base, and when they brought us into this big, big hangar area, and they had all these bunks lined up three high, rows and rows of them, and you were assigned a shipping order, and you were assigned a date that you were going to leave, and an aircraft that you were going to leave on. And we were flying commercial airliners, and if there was something wrong with that airplane, you didn't leave until they got it fixed. And so we had to hang around there. Was something wrong with the airplane we were going on? We didn't leave there until like the day before New Year's Eve. And when you're flying to the Far East, you fly over the international dateline, and the stewardesses come around with a little card. You're now a member of the Tong, you know. You've crossed the international dateline, and you gain a day, I guess it is. And I landed in Long Binh, Vietnam on January 1st, 1968. 1968 was not a very good year there, and I stayed there till December of 21st of 1968. And we had a work schedule that we worked 3 weeks, 7 days a week. On the fourth week, you worked 5 days and you got that weekend off. And being an aviation unit, if there was an airplane going somewhere and they had room on it, you could get on it and go there if you wanted to, which was pretty nice. Because when I got to my unit, I mean, the guy said, okay, Gurney, this is where you get off. And I looked around, and there's two hangars, and there's a bunch of tents. And I'm saying, nah, this isn't the place where I got to go. He said, oh, yeah, this is where you're going to be. And I thought, oh, my God, there's nothing here, you know. There's no stores, no bars, no nothing. It's just so anyways, I found out later that they had a big tent set up with a bar in it. I thought, well, that's all right. They sell beer, Ham's beer in aluminum cans, 10 cents a can. And I thought, well, 10 cents is cheap enough. And so we would work and drink after work. We had work details, sandbagging, stuff like that. And then on the weekend off, if a plane was going to Phuong Tau, you could get on it and go. Or if it was going to Saigon, you could get on it and go. You know, just had to make sure you made it back. Well, the first 90 days that I got there, and I'm only going to speak for myself. Most guys that have been there probably say the same thing. You're very, very careful. You know, you don't know what's going on, and you want to find out what's going on and how dangerous the area you're in and all of that sort of stuff. And you do that the first 90 days. And then there's a six-month period in the middle there where you know what's going on now and you know more or less what to do and what to look out for, and so you get a little relaxed. And then when you get under 100 days, you start counting the days as to when you come back to the world. We used to say 99 days back in the world, you know. And we count the days down. And that February, it was tough. The February that I was there, they had the Tet Offensive, and there was a lot of things happening. We had ground attacks, we had mortar attacks, it got pretty dangerous there. I was a pretty scared guy. It wasn't a very nice place to be. We didn't have any hot running showers. They had these little sheds set out on the edge of the barracks area with big tanks in it with a pipe and a little valve that you turned the valve on and stood underneath the pipe and the water trickled down on you and you washed up and soaped up and shut the pipe off and soaped up, then turn the pipe back on, rinse the soap off you, and that was the shower. And there was no place to shave or anything. You had to get a mirror and hang. We had a little wooden platform outside the barracks here. We had a nail. You hang a mirror on a nail and get a plastic basin or your helmet or whatever and shave out of that in the mornings. And we had money, Roger, because we were with the government. We had six holes in that outhouse. And we had big signs over them outhouses, no smoking, because underneath the bottom of them houses, they had these 55-gallon drums that they had cut the two-thirds of the top off, and they cut a couple of slots in the sides, and they filled them half full of gasoline and half full of diesel fuel. And that's what you did your business in. And then in the mornings, they would have what they call the shit-burning detail. Excuse my English, but that's what they did. We'd take long hooks and we'd grab them slots that they made in them cans and drag them out from underneath them outhouses, two guys, and we would pick one up, one on each side, and set it on top of two. And, you know, you'd have five or six of them all stacked up there, and you'd stand back, throw a match. And you'd go around that was a detail. You'd have catch that detail maybe once a month. What a smell, let me tell you. God, it's terrible. I used to hate that. Anyways, a sad thing happened. There was a kid killed. He was shot. He was right behind me and this other fella, Dickie. And we crawled over to him, and we were telling him to get down, and he didn't listen to us. And he got shot, and he said, and his last words were, "I'm hit, see where it is." And we crawled up to him, and he was laying on his back, and he had a little hole in here with a little strip of blood, and then he had a little hole in the back, his back. The bullet went right through him, but it went right through his heart. He was dead. And we didn't know it. We bandaged him up and called for the medics, and they came, and he's dead, you know. So it was really a scary, scary place to be. And I didn't want to be there. And every time that I could get on an airplane going away from there, I did. And so one weekend, I went to Saigon, and I'm getting pretty well drunk. And I don't know what happened. I got down there on a Saturday morning, and I don't know what happened to Sunday. And I never made the plane going back. And I'm 40 miles away. My base camp is 40 miles away from there. And I wake up in a hotel, and I've got civilian clothes on. I've got a military flak vest with me, a steel pot, and an M14 rifle. It must have been a sight. Hungover, needed a shave, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning. It's still dark out, and I need to get 40 miles up the road before 7 o'clock for Reveille, a stand work formation. And there was an old papasan outside there, and he had one of them little moped taxi things that you ride in the back of. And I'm peeling the money out. I want to go to Long Thon, and he's telling me I'm crazy. You know, you're Dinky Dow. He says, I'm crazy. You were going to get killed. He thought sure in hell he'd get killed going up the road, and there was nothing supposed to move before daylight. So I talked him into taking me to Long Bend. I gave him enough money, and he would take me to Long Bend, which was on the way. And we got to Long Bend, and the sun started coming up, and I gave him a few more bucks, and he took me all the way. And I got into that compound at 6:45 in the morning. I made it. I don't know how I made it, except the guy upstairs was watching me. I used all my luck, and I worked the hell out of my higher power when I was out there drinking. And I don't believe I'll ever hit the Florida State Lottery, that's for sure. I used all my luck up. Anyways, I was lucky. That's only one incident. And I could go on a few more stories like that, but I want to be able to spend some time with sobriety. But anyways, I came back to the United States, and I had a little difficulty with my wife. I was drinking crazy. She left me. She went back to Germany. We got divorced. I'm having problems, personality problems with the people I'm working with. There was a warrant officer who was an excellent pilot. He was a decorated pilot. I couldn't get along with him, and I was the guy. Somehow in Vietnam, I got promoted to staff sergeant, and I'm in charge of the maintenance crew in the hangar, and he wanted this other guy to do the job, and anyway, to make a long story short, he had a friend in personnel, and I was on my way back to Vietnam again to the same damn unit I had just left, which I didn't want to be. And anyways, there's another story about that too. Anyways, but I got back there. I went right back to that same unit, and they didn't have a job for me. I was really upset. I was really upset. They didn't have a job for me, so they needed a guy to take care of, to be in charge of a security platoon. And since I knew the area very well, because I helped build it in 1968, they said, you would be good for that. You know the area, and we could use you as a security platoon sergeant. So I did that. It was a job I had. And I did that for about 3 or 4 months. My dad got sick. The Red Cross was called. I came back to the States. I had gotten married before I went the second time. My first wife had left and got divorced, and I met a girl in the NCO club, and I married her before I went back to Vietnam. And she thought I was going to get killed, and she'd collect the GI insurance and be taken care of anyways. She didn't. I came back early. Where are you? She said. I said, I'm in San Francisco. Meet me in Dulles. We're going to Massachusetts. My dad's sick and he's dying. And we went to Massachusetts. She didn't like the cold. She didn't like me drunk. And so she left. She left a little note on the kitchen table. Thanks for a year in hell. Anyway, she was gone, so now it was party time. My dad passed away, and I was still in the Army. I didn't have very much time left to do, but I was stationed at Fort Devens for the few months that he lived, and I was going to be shipped to Alaska. I had 77 days left, something like that, on that enlistment. I got out of the Army. I said, I'm not going. They wanted to send me to Alaska. I said, I don't want to go. I'm not going to reenlist. You'll have to just put me out. So I signed an intent not to reenlist. I got out of the military, and with an honorable discharge, thank you, God. And I got in an 18-wheeler. And I was drinking. And, man, I'm telling you, it's hard to drive an 18-wheeler and drink. The bars do not have parking lots big enough to put them things in. You can't just park them on the street and walk in. You have to try and hide them. It's very difficult. It really cut into my drinking time. I tended bar at the VFW for a little while, and I was driving a school bus for a little while, and part-time, and in walked my third wife. She came into the VFW with her sister, and it was just before Thanksgiving time. I was just about to get out of the Army anyways, and so I thought it would be a good idea to get married, because I wasn't going to be able to afford to keep the apartment I was in if I got out of the military. And I got married, and I got married in March of 1973, and in July of 73, I was out of the house. Involved with another woman, and it was my life just a little bit insane, you know. I mean, it was crazy. From 1966 to 1973, I was married and divorced 3 times. 7 years. I mean, it was crazy. I came back. I finally left the job I had up there, and I came back to New Bedford where I originally came from, and I was going to get sober there. And I got a job driving a truck in a Teamsters Union. Thank God for the Teamsters Union. I would have lost the job. Somebody else, I would have been fired. But they kept the job, and I went to a detox the first time, and then 2 rehabs. Because when I got out of the detox, I went there to save a relationship and a job. And when I got there, I got to AA. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't join a group. And I didn't do the steps. I didn't do anything but just sit there and listen to speaker meetings. And I finally got sick of that and walked out. And I didn't know if I was an alcoholic or not. And I played a little game. You know, I'm going to just have two drinks tonight. And that's all. And I did that one weekend. And I did that for the whole next week. I went out and I did what I was supposed to do. And the next weekend, I went out and had a few more drinks. And I'm not an alcoholic. I didn't drink all week. I ate. I did my job. I had it. Well, by the end of the month, I went out on Friday night. And I don't know what happened to Saturday and Sunday. I woke up Monday morning. And I thought, oh, boy, here I am again, right in the shit. And I was. Excuse my English. Anyways, I ended up going to a rehab. I get out of that rehab, and this time I'm gonna stick around. I'm not gonna drink. I don't want to drink. I know I'm an alcoholic. I know that I got a problem, and so I'm gonna go to AA on a regular basis, and I'm not gonna do the every other day stuff. I'm gonna go every day, and I'm gonna stay sober. And I did, but I didn't get a sponsor, and I didn't join a group, and I didn't work the steps. And I don't know, I was there about 6 months, 7 months, and of course I belonged to the VFW and the American Legion, right, because I was in the service. And so on Veterans Day, November the 11th, 19, I forget what year it was anyway, I got sober in February of 81, so it would have been 1980. November the 11th, 1980, Veterans Day. I'm going to march in the parade. I'm not drinking. I'm going to AA every day. I'm going to march in the parade. And, you know, you march in the parade, the VFW that you belong to, they got free drinks for the guys that are marching in the parade. And so this guy comes out with a big tray full of beers, and, yeah, everybody's helping themselves to a beer, and I didn't think anything of it. And I grabbed that beer, and I started drinking it, and I thought, what the hell am I doing? Oh, well, it's too late now. And I'm not going to come. I don't know how these people do it, drink one day and come back the next. I'm not coming back until my butt's on fire, I'm telling you. And so I'm out there, and I'm drinking again, and I'm getting in trouble on the job again. And I was scared. I was going to have New Year's Day was going to be my sobriety date. I'm going to quit New Year's Day. I'm going to get through Thanksgiving and Christmas, the holidays. My sobriety date, January 1st, right? Well, January 1st came and went, and I'm still drinking, and I can't stop, and I want to stop, and I'm buying a couple of beers here and a couple of beers there, and I'm tapering off. I'm going to taper. I'm going to wean myself off of this stuff. Well, I'm so sick. My hangovers are so bad. They're lasting until Wednesday now. You know, it's just really bad. I can't eat. I've got the shakes, starting to hallucinate a little bit. And, man, I'm telling you, I'm in bad shape. And I did that whole month of January. I put myself through hell trying to stop, and I couldn't. And I finally called and begged that rehab one more time to take me back. And thank God it was after the first of the year, so the insurance kicked in for the next year, and I was able to go. This time, I joined a group. I got a sponsor. I didn't get into working the steps right away. I met a friend of mine in AA by the name of Jackson. I used to drink with him once in a while, and he used to say, do the Jackson 5, you know. He'd say, just when you get up in the morning, ask a power grade in yourself, Not to help you stay away from a drink. Number two, join a group. Number three, get a sponsor. If you got one, speak to them. Number four, plan your day around a meeting. Get to a meeting. Number five, say thank you at the end of the night. I did that for 2.5 years. It kept me sober in AA. That's the truth. I didn't do the steps. I just did that. I just concentrated on staying sober. And I got sober. Now, I retired. I finally did steps. I finally got involved in the steps. My behavior was bad. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. I told my sponsor some things. He said, man, you got to get in steps. I got into the steps, and my life changed even more. Things got better and better. And 7 years ago, I retired at the age of 60, and I came down here to Florida. and I found Florida AA. I knew where the Back Porch Lunch Bunch was. I had been to that meeting when it was on Umelton Road. And I found out that it had moved, and I found out where it was, over there in the D. George Plaza on Stocky Road. I went over there, and I met the people over there, and then I got involved with the Monday Night Speakers meeting. And, man, I'm off and running in AA, and, man, I just love Florida AA. It's terrific. Between the two groups, they keep me busy. I was the treasurer for 2 years at the back porch. I'm the assistant treasurer there. I'm the greeter at the Monday Night Speakers meeting. I'm the assistant, whatever they need at the Monday Night Speakers meeting. If they need assistant secretary or whatever, I do that job. And so it just keeps me busy, and I love it. If anybody was to tell me that 30 years ago that I'd be living in Florida, taking vacations, going up north in the summertime and coming back to Florida, I'd have told them they're crazier than hell. I never had a dime saved towards retirement when I came into AA, and yet I retired when I was 60. So if you're new here and you think you're going to have to work forever, that's what I thought. You may not. God has a plan. We don't know what it is. You know, the best job of your life could show up, or the best investment you could ever make in something will happen. And we don't know what kind of, it's not always smooth. It's sometimes up and down, but it beats the heck out of where it used to be. There's no more insanity like it used to be. And you kind of get used to that quietness, you know. I love it. I love that peace and quiet now sometimes. Instead of that god-awful, what do they call that? Not turmoil, but the stuff that goes on all the time, you know. I hate that today. I couldn't deal with it today. And so my life is full, you know. And you know something else that was funny that happened? I never got married again. I stayed sober and I stayed single. I've had a couple of serious relationships through the years, but seemed like every time I was ready to ask somebody to marry me, something happened and she was off with somebody else. And so I said, well, maybe it's not meant to be. But anyways, I'm a pretty happy guy. I really am. I love this group. I love you guys. I've had a lot of you guys come down and speak at the Wednesday night speakers meeting down there at the back porch, and I heard some of you speak at the Monday night speakers meeting, and it's just been terrific. I love you, and I'd like to see this thing just keep going. These empty seats, get them filled up. See you later.